We're doing the Jewish Yom.
Sorry, Rav.
We're up to Pirkei Avot. The fifth chapter. We're in the middle of the 11th Mishnah. The Mishnah taught us Arba Midot Badot. There are four types of personalities. A person who angers easily and then is easily appealed. So the losses outweigh the benefits, because at the end of the day, he angers easily. You have people who are hard to anger but hard to appease, so then the loss is outweighed by the benefit, because at least they're hard to anger. A person who's hard to anger and easy to appease is a chassid, and a person who's easy to anger and hard to appease is a rasha. And we began discussing this idea that the Mishnah tells us he is wicked. Meaning the Mishnah doesn't just say, well, poor guy, he's got a short fuse, that's a guy who's a hothead. No, the Mishnah says very clear. Whereas other Mishnayot said some people have it better, some people have it worse, some people have better memory, some people have worse, some people understand quicker. Some people retain more, some people understand more slowly, some people retain less. This Mishnah says no. This is about who we are going to choose to be. Are we going to be a pious person or a wicked person? The chassid is one who makes it hard for him to anger. And at the end of the day, people are born with different natures. You have people who, as kids, are the biggest hotheads in the world. But it's up to them to work on themselves. And then a person can become hard to anger. You have people who their nature is to bear a grudge. And they'll do anything but give in. But they work on themselves. So that's a chassid. What's a rasha? The Mishnah said if he's easy to anger and hard to appease. And we brought a story about that world-renowned artist who had a special honing stone for his blades. And one time his wife got upset at him. The stone was in his knapsack and his bag. And she took the bag and she said, why you leave it in the middle of the room, tossed it across the room, and he heard a crack. And that's where we left it last week. So he walks across the room and opens his bag. And he looks into the stone. And he sees the stone that had been in his family, I don't know for how many generations, and it's cracked. And it's irreplaceable. There's nothing he can do now. So now the question is, what do you do? Meaning, it's done. She destroyed the stone. So she had a moment.
I don't think she knew it.
Meaning, she might not have cared to know it, but she didn't know it. The way he told the story to me, she didn't know it. She was upset. He left his bag in the middle of the room, so without thinking, she threw it across the room.
It's a true story.
This is a true story. I know the individuals involved, the husband and the wife. It's a true story.
It's you?
No. I'm not such an artist. Anyways, I would never admit it was me. But no, in this case, it happens to be it's not me. But that's not a fair question. Don't do that to me again, because the next time it might be, you never know. So at any rate, we all know how we would like to react in such a scenario. We'd like to calmly put down the bag and just maybe shake our heads and what can you do? You know, it's over. Not the marriage, the stone.
Yeah.
No. But this involves a person working on himself. And that's where a person has to get to. I think it was the Belzer Rebbe who came to visit the Gera Rebbe. I think I'm getting the names right. And when he walked in, the Gera Rebbe was leaning over a Sefer Learning, And he looked at him and he felt like he saw the Shekhinah there, the tranquility and the serenity that enveloped the Rebbe as he was learning over his Gemara. And the Rebbe looked up, and the Belzer Rebbe came and sat down, and they spoke, and they didn't agree. And the conversation became heated, and they spoke back and forth, and they didn't agree. And they conclude the conversation in disagreement. And the Belzer Rebbe had to get up to leave. And so the Belzer Rebbe left the room, and as he was leaving, he turned around, and he saw the Ger Rebbe leaning over his Gemara, the same serenity, the same focus, the same calm, tranquility. He went to his Hasidim and he said, now I know the Ger Rebbe is really a giant. Because the argument that we had was external to him. And he didn't let himself become a part of it. When Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach eulogized his wife, he said the famous line, he said, the custom is that a person asks his wife for forgiveness at the burial, but I don't think I have to ask you for forgiveness. Our whole lives I lived in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch. I never did anything that was unfair or unkind or improper to you. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he lived with his wife, I don't remember how many decades, 4 or 5 decades. And he said, but maybe I forgot something, you know, I'm a human being, it could be, and being that the custom is to ask forgiveness, so I am going to ask you forgiveness. So everyone was shocked. All over the world, people were talking about this. How could that be? And so someone finally had the gall to ask him, Rebbe, you never argued with your wife? So he looked at him and said, sure, I argued with my wife. So he said, then what do you mean? So he said, well, marriage is about making things work, right? So sometimes we can argue, sometimes we can disagree, but it should never become personal. The fact that I disagree with her, she disagrees with me, that's legitimate. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that. We can argue. I could say my opinion. She could say her opinion. Could go back and forth. We can explain why we feel differently. But that's within the confines of halacha. That's right. There's nothing wrong with that. Part of marriage is that we will sometimes disagree. But it never got personal. I never said something to hurt her. I never said something that I shouldn't have said to her. The Mishnah teaches us we have the capacity to control, and therefore we have the responsibility to control our anger. And a person has to know, as we discussed last week, there is that moment when a person decides not to have control. There's that moment when a person decides, I'm going to let him have it. And then the words come spewing forth, and then sometimes you say, well, I didn't think I was going to say that. I didn't really mean to say that. Stop. The Mishnah says we have to work to be hard to anger and easy to appease. Two difficult qualities. It's hard. And it's harder within a marriage because it's that same person you're waking up to every single day. It's not like a roommate. It's not even like a parent. You can't walk into the room and shut the door and goodbye. No, it's a central part of your life. It's the greatest blessing in your life. It's the source of the greatest tranquility and pleasure and happiness and mutual benefit and mutual building. Well, in order for it to be all that, there has to be peace. And that's not easy because it's mutual. And it's the same person again and again and again. It's that same person who pushes the toothpaste from the middle. And you could explain to them 15,000 times that's not a good idea. You're never going to be able to finish the toothpaste. So we had a guy who once asked me, if your wife leaves the milk out every single night. So I said, either put it back after her or invest 5 shekel a day and realize that's your investment in Shalom Bayis. You're not getting anywhere. You're talking to her. It's not getting anywhere. What's the use in getting upset? Sometimes in life we have to be able to say, okay. So then that's the fact of life. One of the reasons we find it difficult to make peace with things is because we've built this image of how things should look. You guys know the story of Pygmalion? Okay, so now I'll tell you a story my Rebbe told me when I was dating. I'll give you the application in dating and then back the application in marriage. In Greek mythology, there was a man named Pygmalion. And he was a world-renowned sculptor So all the suitors would come to him and say, we have a shidduch for you. Come see this girl, see that girl. Every girl he'd go out with, he'd come back and say, no, that's not what I was looking for. Until finally he got fed up with the suitors. He said, I'll show you what I'm looking for. And he went and took a huge slab of stone and started chiseling. And he formed the idea of the exact girl that he wanted. And then he said to the suitors, that's the girl I want to marry. So they all said, well, we don't have any girl like that. And he said, fine, so then I'll pray to Zeus. So day in and day out, he started praying. And he prayed to Zeus. And then one fine day, the statue took life and walked off the pedestal. And they walked off into the sunset and they lived happily ever after. So in Greek mythology, where you have a million different idols you could pray to and things like this happen, so fine. So my Rebbe said to me, you can't enter dating with this figurine and think which girl's going to match that. And it's not only the physical features we're talking about, we're also talking about the personality traits. You have to see what matches. But you can't match up a girl to your imagination. If it works, then it works, even though it's not what you imagined. You have to see if it really works. And my brother added to that, that in dating we all go through two stages. When you meet Mrs. Wright, the first stage is the willingness to bash the idol. Meaning, my brother said to me, and I think there's truth to that by many people, that many people go dating and they have that vision of what they want. And then they meet Mrs. Wright and she doesn't match what they thought there is Mrs. Wright is going to be. So before them is a live woman who really seems to match. And in their imagination, there's some kind of imaginary woman who they thought would be the right one. And my brother said to me, the first step, you have to be willing to bash the imaginary one. And then the second step is you have to be willing to see that this is Mrs. Wright standing there before you. You have to be able to do both. And some people are never willing to cross that threshold. So they remain with that imaginary, oh, that if only she'd walk off the pedestal. But she doesn't. Never happened. Never going to happen. So coming back to our story, part of the reason within marriage that people have this difficulty is because they still have that woman on the pedestal. Meaning, they still think, well, if only she would be. And there's another fantastic story about a professor. I don't remember what the name of the story is. It's a short story. One of the American classics. There was this wild professor who had an amazing wife, and she was perfect. She was the perfect wife. And he was so happy with her. The only problem was she had one little wart on her nose. You know the story? So he decided that she's perfect except for that little wart. And he's going to help her get rid of it. So this became his focus. And he started preparing different concoctions. And he's experimenting. And finally he comes to her and he says, I have it. After you drink this, you will be 100% perfect. And he gives her this liquid to drink, and she drinks it, and he watches, and before his very eyes, it grows smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it disappears, and she drops dead. So this is a famous American short story. I don't remember the name of the story, but the idea is the same. Perfection is what you have. Perfection is not an imagined perfection. One of the reasons we get frustrated with our spouse is because we keep matching them up with what we'd like them to be. Stop. This is good. This is very good. This is perfect. One husband once asked me, and I get this question often, do you mean to tell me that after everything you've heard, you think my wife is perfect? For you? That's right. She's perfect for you. You're not perfect. She's not perfect. You match. But how could you say that in light of the fact that she does A and B and C and D? Okay. Make it work. But she's throwing dishes at me when she's upset. Okay. Make it work. Make it work.
I read something last week where they were trying to get a share for this guy who had the worst effort. Just constantly walked a little sick. And the Rebbe said, found the perfect share. Tommy didn't say, oh, the guy's just an ogre. He said, I found a woman with an even bigger temper than his. She shuts him up.
I've seen that. I had a friend, well, a classmate, who was the nastiest person I could imagine. So sarcastic and so nasty. And his wife is just more at it than he is. And he adores her. Okay. You know, he told me once, she's my general. She's the one person I don't dare stand up to. Okay, fine. That's what he needed. Fine, perfect for him. What can I say?
What about another story? Like, someone meets a woman that he... It's like the stone, the carved stone we were speaking about. She's truly like this. But his relationship with her doesn't work out. So the second woman that he will find, he will try to be like the first one, right? Who also looks like the, you know, the image that he carved in his mind about how perfect woman should like. So in fact, the second woman this time doesn't have to surpass an idol; she has to surpass the first girl that you have in mind. So what's going on there? Because it's not simple. Because the first girl is a human; it's not just an idol in your mind. But she matches with the idol of your mind. It even didn't work as necessary. So it's not easy for you to find the second one, first of all. And if you find the second one, it's not easy for her to surpass the first girl of your mind. Right?
I'm just thinking, being that this class is in the Jewish home, I could answer you in the realm of the Jewish home, but I would rather give you a more detailed answer with regard to dating. But that's not really, it doesn't really fit our class. So I'm just contemplating whether we should discuss it and then you won't get as good an answer, or push it off to Thursday night. And you know what, we could discuss it in the realm of the Jewish home. And then if you raise it again on Thursday night, we could discuss it again in the realm of dating. Even though many of the ideas overlap, there are some which do not. This idea that Malachi raises is really more common than you think. Meaning, Malachi is saying, you dated a girl and she seemed great, but then she told you no. And then you met someone else and you start thinking, does she match up to that? So let me give you an example from married life. Your neighbor's wife is pretty. Your neighbor's wife is diligent. Your neighbor's wife never yells at him. Your neighbor's wife seems to always have the kids in order. It doesn't have to be the girl you dated. It could also be the girl you dated. But it could also be your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's husband. He suddenly gets a new car. He gets his wife new coats. He's always helping cleaning the floor, taking the kids out. He never yells at her. He's doing the shopping, the cooking, the cleaning, the laundering, picking up the kids, dropping off the kids. What a great husband. Now, this can very easily happen. And in psychology, they refer to it as the better other. Meaning it's very common that either spouse will find someone to compare their spouse to. The husband compares the wife compares the husband. Someone who's just perfect or just much, much better. Sometimes people compare themselves to that person. So that's where your question really, it's a real question. It's a real problem that people contend with. There are many answers to the question. The first answer is one of the first things that a person has to learn in marriage, and that is that marriage can only work if you focus on what you have, if you focus on the blessings that you have, on how good you have it. You imagine you know how well things are going by someone else. You don't really know. You see the good and you don't see the problems. You don't see the issues. You'll have to take my word for it, and you won't want to take my word for it, because in your imagination, if you only let it go wild, then no one has it as bad as me. Every person can tell you that. Every person can explain to you why my wife is a witch. My husband, he's the laziest bum in the world. He's so unreliable. He says he'll come at this hour and he doesn't come. He says we won't spend more than this budget and he does. He says he'll call my parents, wish them a good Shabbos and he doesn't. I could give you examples, endless examples. He doesn't show up to Minyan on time. He doesn't daven diligently. He doesn't learn diligently. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Sometimes he tells Allah and he gets it wrong. Whatever realm you're going to discuss, there's going to be room to find fault. And every wife and every husband can find a lot of fault in their spouse. It's up to us. It's really up to us how we're going to view it. And it sounds like a cliche. It's up to you. Will you see the cup half full or will you see the cup half empty? No. Your cup is really all the way full. If you decide to put it in a cup that's bigger, so then it's going to seem half full. But it's up to you what kind of cup you're going to look at the juice in. The juice is really a full cup. You got a full cup. You chose to put it in a cup that makes it half full. It's not even half full.
But this can be about the person's personality generally.
It's about every aspect of life. It's about every aspect of your spouse. It's a question of what you look at. And us men have this recurring fault of being fuyei tova. Just as Adam denied the good that Eve provided him, he only saw her faults, so too we are repeating that same mistake throughout our lives. It's part of our nature. It's part of what we have to overcome in this world.
But what you say also is it applied to us, you know, ourselves, how we see ourselves. Because, for example, we might be great personalities, great persons, right? And at the same time, you're saying that I'm not as tzaddik as him. I try to compare my, you know, my personality, which my level might be great, you know, very good or very bad. And I try to compare with someone bigger than me, and I look small again, right? I never look that I am satisfied with how I am. I always look smaller than in my eyes.
Because I don't know.
You can compare your wife to someone else.
So I think a balanced person has to view himself realistically and say, what can I do and what can't I do? And then come to terms with what I've accomplished and think how I can accomplish more in whatever realm I can. But I can only look at someone else in as much as I can learn from them. But I can't say, just because they've accomplished this much, I should be able to. I wasn't given their strengths. I wasn't given their tools. I wasn't given their settings. Okay, so...
When we compare our wife to someone else, to a different wife, with different beauty or different personality, the mistake is that we would like our wife to be like her, not to like see...
No, the mistake is also that we're allowing our imaginations to go wild. You don't know what she is really like. You don't know what's going on there. You see the facade and you choose to zone in on one point. Yeah, you call your friend and he tells you, oh, my wife is so amazing, she baked me a cake in honor of my birthday. And you think to yourself, my wife forgot my birthday. Yeah, what you don't know is that his wife poured hot chont on his head on Shabbos because he said one word that she didn't like. So yeah, she felt like she owes it to him. So she baked him a cake for his birthday. That part he doesn't tell you. There are a million things that people don't tell you. There are a million things that you don't see. What?
I was going to say that the happiest people you know are the people you don't know.
Right. Right, that's so true.
But also the situation you're imagining, that other spouse that you think is so much better than yours, that she would want you.
Even if she would, she wouldn't be.
I'm just saying, there's also that imagination that if only I had chosen this person quite possibly would have looked at you and said, well, you know, you're not up to my speed.
But even if, I'm just saying, I don't want to go that route. Let's assume she would. Let's assume she would agree. But you know, that's, if you were married, then you'd have a million other issues or identical issues and then some. You know, that's why people have affairs. Because in marriage, there's all this obligation, so there's all this hardship. An affair, what's the big deal? We meet for 2 hours a week. We could have a great time. We walk away, there's no commitment, there's nothing. So everyone could be nice and pleasant and friendly and everything's beautiful. Go sit under one roof together. Go build something with the person. Go do something worthwhile. Then you suddenly realize, this isn't what I thought it was. On the surface, from a distance, we could look that way. And the key is that we shouldn't be looking. That's why the Torah says, Lo tachmod. Don't desire it. Don't go looking and thinking down that road. But it's true that it takes self-discipline. Our nature is that we do think that way. And a person has to have the self-discipline to realize that in a true sense, there's really nothing better out there. And in an idealistic sense, so I shouldn't be thinking down that road. My thoughts have to be focused, very focused here. This is where I am. This is where I've settled. This is what I want. And this is where I can build.